Welcome to the latest episode of the Few and Far Between podcast. I'm your host, Chris O'Brien. We all know that fresh ideas drive today's biotech industry, but establishing intellectual property rights for innovations and inventions is equally vital in order to power growth, investment, and the actualization of bringing new products to the patients who need them. Patents and trade secrets are the most important types of intellectual property for biotech and biopharma. However, figuring out how and when to protect IP can be a bit tricky without the proper strategy and guidance. On today's episode, we are fortunate to have three individuals from IPI, the IP Policy Institute at the University of Akron School of Law, a Washington, D.C.-based entity that defines and educates to protect innovation in industries including biotech. Joshua Kresch, Mark Schultz, and Emily Machiko Morris bring their industry expertise to the Few and Far Between podcast today for a Q&A on the proper usage of patents and trade secrets to protect biotech IP, from security and collaboration to territorial rights and the proper timing for establishing IP. We also zoom in on the current regulatory landscape and the latest policy changes in the U.S. This was a fascinating discussion on the do's and don'ts in IP protection, so be sure to check out the links in the comments to connect with the Intellectual Property Policy Institute for more information. Okay, let's start the podcast. Okay, Joshua, Mark, and Emily, welcome to Few and Far Between.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So let's jump right in. What are some of the biggest things that people get wrong about intellectual property? Emily, can you start us out with a little bit of a frame?
Sure. So I assume that a lot of your listeners already know the different types of intellectual property and what roles they play. But for those who don't, I think the first thing that they need to understand is that there is a difference between the four most important types of intellectual property, which are patents, trade secrets, trademarks, and copyrights. They are not the same thing. They do have different roles in the promoting biotechnology or other types of technology. So it's important to understand what the differences are. And for those in science and technology, really, it's patents and trade secrets that are probably going to be the most relevant. So for biotech companies and other tech companies, patents really are the go-to type of protection for their inventions. Patents, although they require a lot of time and money to acquire and are relatively short in duration, only 20 years, and have fairly rigorous eligibility standards, they offer probably the most robust protections of all intellectual property. So patents provide you the exclusive rights to make, use, and sell your invention for the 20-year duration, and those rights are good regardless of whether someone even knows about your patent, is trying to copy your invention, or even independently invented the exact same invention. You can still exert your exclusive rights against them regardless of those things. And they're also good even if someone else is using your invention as only a small part of their larger invention, right? There's no kind of proportionality or anything like that with regard to patent rights. And so patents can be worth millions or even billions of dollars, depending on what technology you're in. And the only really meaningful alternative to patent protections is trade secrecy. And trade secrecy is kind of your do-it-yourself type of intellectual property protection. So as long as you invest in what we call reasonable measures to maintain secrecy, you can assert your trade secret protection in court. But the two big problems with trade secrets is that trade secrecy protects you only against those who knowingly commit some sort of misconduct in order to misappropriate or otherwise steal your trade secret. So it doesn't protect against reverse engineering. It doesn't protect against someone else coming up with the same invention or trade secret at the same time as you. And so the protections under trade secrecy are much more limited. And a second, even bigger problem with trade secrecy is that not everything can be kept secret. Yeah. A lot of technologies, especially if you sell them on the open market, can be easily copied or easily reverse engineered. And so trade secrecy really ends up being most useful for things like processes of manufacturing or even processes of using, anything that you can use behind closed doors. But a lot of other technologies, again, as we say, wear their know-how on their face. So they're really not good fodder for trade secrecy protection.
Terrific.
Yeah. So that being said, copyright, trademark was great for any business, but copyright really doesn't play much of a role. Copyright mostly is going to be relevant for perhaps a scientific article or some advertising materials, but really it's patents and trade secrets that you want to be looking at.
Very, very helpful. Mark, tell us a little bit about what people can do with a patent, specifically in this sphere in, you know, pharma and biotech world.
Well, sure. So I think a lot of people think that IP rights exist to enable you to sue people. And right. A lot of practicing lawyers have that misconception, and understandably so, because not only, you know, some of them own not one, but two houses and put their kids through school suing people on behalf of IP owners. But, you know, think of why you have any property right. You don't buy a house or buy an office building or set up a bar or restaurant so that you can sue trespassers and fend them off. You do that because you have a use for it, because you want to invest in it, improve it, and build something that improves your lives, allows you to collaborate with others. And that's why IP rights exist. Yes, you need the credible threat of a lawsuit sometimes, right? You know, if you didn't have the law to back you up, who knows? Maybe your big bully neighbor would come and squat on your property and take it away. But really what's most important is the beneficial collaborations and investment that IP rights allow. You know, for every lawsuit filed, there's just millions of win-win situations created by IP rights every day. And that's the important thing about them. And to get a little less abstract about it, it's, you know, IP rights create security. They create security for investment. If somebody can just copy what you've done, then you can't get people to invest in it. You could be working on the coolest science. You could have the best idea, but without IP rights, investors aren't going to invest in it because their money could easily evaporate if a competitor copies your innovation without protection. We saw this during the pandemic that IP rights enabled collaboration, and people were more willing to collaborate, wanted to collaborate at light speed, and they did. One great example, I did a big research project on the role of IP in fighting COVID. One great example happened that Pfizer told me about. So Pfizer worked with a biotech company, BioNTech, the smaller, publicly held but smaller company. BioNTech had the mRNA vaccine technology. Pfizer had the scale, manufacturing expertise, and regulatory expertise and distribution, everything it needed to, you know, ramp up production. So there was a natural potential marriage there. And so in early March, 5 years ago, 2020, got together. They quickly signed some non-disclosure agreements. And before they even had figured out how they were going to divide up the pie, before they signed all the official agreements about their collaboration, they started sharing information. And they did that knowing that IP rights would keep them secure. What Pfizer said, what Pfizer's IP counsel said is, like, yeah, I can't speak for them, but I can't imagine they would have, you know, dared work with a company our size without the security of IP rights. That was repeated throughout the pandemic. You know, Pfizer then, you know, developed this manufacturing technology for the vaccines. They turned around, and because they had to produce billions of doses and nobody had that capacity themselves, who did have that capacity potentially? Their biggest competitors. So they worked with Sanofi and Merck and other giant companies and taught them how to make the vaccines. They taught them this new technology.
Yeah, that's crazy when you think about it, right?
Yeah. And that was IP rights that enabled that. They couldn't have done anything without that kind of security. So it's kind of a paradox. People are like, oh, you need IP rights to protect yourself. You need IP rights to be able to sue infringers. All those things are true. But really what they do is they create that security and trust that's necessary to get the investments you need and to do the collaboration you need out there in the world to accomplish great things.
That's a fantastic reset. I do think most people think of patents as a defensive maneuver, the way that you protect your intellectual property. But thinking about it as this tool that ignites and enables collaboration is a wonderful reset. Joshua, did you want to weigh in on this as well, on kind of the role of patents here and the importance of patents?
I think Mark really covered it. And I think, you know, it's really the key is that litigating, while an important part of patents, is really small. The vast majority of patents are never going to be litigated. And the main use for patents is not litigation. It is an important backstop, but it is not the sole purpose. And I think a lot of lawyers who are litigators kind of focus on, well, I'm a litigator, so that's what I do. But it doesn't mean that's how companies should focus about patents.
Yeah, if you're a hammer, every problem looks like a nail, right? As they say. Okay, that's great. So let's talk a little bit about how you navigate IP landscape that Emily sort of framed for us. And Mark, you've talked already a little bit about how patent rights provide this security that enables investment and collaboration. But do you want to go a little deeper on that?
Oh, sure. So, you know, I think that when we look at IP rights, it's good to understand them as a system and they complement each other. And so if you look at, say, patents and even trademarks often, because trademarks represent your brand identity, those things can be sort of like the peak of the mountaintop. They're the crown jewels of the company. They're amazing things, assets you need to protect. But underneath that peak of the mountain is a whole mountain range of research and development and confidential business information you built up. And that's trade secrets, right? You could work for many years on something before you have a patentable invention. That's typical, right? You know, a patent requires that you actually have invented something. That takes a while, takes a lot of work, but along the way, you fail, but you fail upward. You learn a lot. You succeed also incrementally. And all those steps, all that information needs to be protected. So trade secrecy is important. Figuring out how to protect that information, how to take that information and have internal corporate programs that, you know, value that information, that your employees understand it's valuable, that it needs to be, you know, treasured and reported and understood as potentially patentable inventions, helps to create this whole body of work that a company can think about strategically and use various forms of IP to protect. And in doing so, the youngest companies in doing so signal their sophistication to potential investors. And potential investors come in and they look, and they don't necessarily expect you to have the most sophisticated IP strategy in the world. It often takes more money to develop that. But what they do want is security. You know, they want to understand that, you know, you have fundamental security that when they invest, they have an opportunity to potentially get a return on their investment. Because we all know that it's really risky. The science makes things risky. The regulatory environment makes things risky. The pricing environment makes things risky. There's a lot of reasons you might not succeed, but what you don't want is to succeed and then have your success just copied without recourse. So, you know, that's what people are looking for, some fundamental security.
Don't need any extra degrees of difficulty by failing to protect
exactly.
Your IP. Would you guys, whoever would like to respond on this, when in the process, imagine you just formed a new biotech company. Are you patenting right away? Is that a priority? Or how do you think about the when on that, if to the extent that you can, you know, offer some advice? Emily?
Yeah, so I can weigh in on that. So typically, especially in biotechnology, but probably other technologies as well, you do want to get those patent rights as soon as possible. That's in part to do exactly what Mark talked about, signal that you have something real, that you have a real invention there. It's in part, especially if you're a smaller entrepreneur, to try to attract that kind of capital and financing, because a lot of the capital companies won't invest in a technology unless you have a patent. But also, as Mark talked about, you have to go through this whole regulatory process for a lot of biotechnology. If it's a medical device or a pharmaceutical or a biologic, there are these huge regulatory hurdles that you have to overcome in order to get your product on the market. Those things can cost billions of dollars and 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years, right? So you need to have some sort of protection right from the get-go. You can't wait and see, oh, do I have a marketable product? You need to have that patent right up front so that you can assure, exactly as Mark said, that your investment is secure.
That's great. That makes a lot of sense. Josh, did you want to say something there?
Yeah, the other thing I'll say on timing, if you're doing it all internally and there's no public disclosure, you're not talking to anyone, you're not writing anything, you have some time. The second you want to publish something or you want to show it somewhere, or you want to talk to someone, you're setting yourself for a lot of trouble if you don't have at least an application on file. It doesn't mean you have to have the issued patent. You have to have something with the PTO, otherwise you're creating prior art against yourself and you're not going to be able to get something. So that's something, particularly for a company that's trying to make a deal or trying to do something else, they really need to have something filed. At least a provisional, and that's talk to them, trying to get details about what's involved for each. But if you don't have that, you're risking that you can't get anything ever, which is a big deal.
That's really helpful. Most folks are going to need to talk to somebody, whether it's an investor or a collaborator or whatever it might be. So if you're getting out into the world and your concepts are being shared, talk to a patent attorney, talk to a professional.
Yeah, Chris, it's one of the truths of biotech. All your listeners are aware of it's not really a garage startup culture.
Correct, yeah.
And so often you see that the teams that eventually succeed or that launch a success, they usually include somebody with some level of sophistication who's been there, done something before, and knows some of the ins and outs and knows what lawyers to talk to and when to talk to them. And if you don't have somebody like that on your team, it's really good to get them involved, which is kind of just a truism.
I mean, I think folks count on, that's what early stage startups look to boards for, look to their investors for, right? Is to access that kind of expertise. But I do think know that you need to get it early is good advice. Let's talk a little bit about international IP strategy and protection. We've been, I think, mostly focused on the US for obvious reasons, but how should people think about international IP rights? You've got a limited amount of money that you want to spend, but Mark, do you want to start us off? How important is that and when should that happen in the process?
Yeah, so I think the important thing to understand about IP rights is they're territorial. So what that means is if you have a US patent, you have protection in the US, period, full stop. You don't have protection in Europe or China or Japan. You have to go through their patent offices too. Now, there's been a lot of harmonization over the decades. So it's not that the systems are wildly separated, but you still have to file there. Now, fortunately, there's something called the Patent Cooperation Treaty that allows you to file in one place and gives you a year to pursue your patent before you actually have to enter into what we call the national stage in those other countries. So you don't have to pay their fees and spend money on lawyers in those countries for a period. And that gives you some time, that grace period gives you some time to kind of test out your patent. So that's kind of the technical answer. I think there are different pieces of the strategy that apply here. Like, first of all, like, yes, you may be developing a product, a treatment that, of course, you want to sell around the world. And when you get to that stage, even then, you're not going to necessarily file a patent in every country in the world because they can't all produce your drug or your treatment. You're probably going to file in the places that have the capacity to compete with you, say India and Europe, of course, and Japan and China. That's one consideration. Rolling it back to the startup stage, you know, if you're working on your early pieces of technology, it may be that the most important thing is to get the US protection initially if you're developing your technology at early stages, at least in the biotech world, where you probably will have to go through further stages of development before you have innovated your way to a marketable treatment that the patients can use. And it may be at that point where you have the money and the sophisticated advice that you need to develop an international strategy. But you do need to keep in mind, like, where people are likely to be competing with you. And if you're working on a fundamental technology that's also being developed by a Canadian or European company, for example, you may need to consider even in an early stage getting those patents in those places.
So think about who could compete, look at the competitive set, and then sort of act accordingly and pursue multiple patents. That makes a lot of sense. Does anybody else want to weigh in here on international patent strategy?
So I'll just say, you know, Mark said that a lot of these countries have now at least partially harmonized their IP protections. This is in part because of the TRIPS agreement, which is an agreement that was established by the World Trade Organizations back in 1995. But the TRIPS agreement really provides only a minimum type of protection and only kind of the minimum standards for awarding those kinds of protections. So there's still a fair amount of variation amongst countries in how they provide protections and how they allow people to enforce those protections. And some of these countries, you know, they didn't implement some of these protections until fairly recently. So China, India didn't really implement some of these protections until 2005, partially because it required a huge shift, not only in the law, but also kind of in the culture for these countries. So China and India, for example, didn't allow patents on pharmaceuticals or biologics. And so that was really a big shift in not only the legal paradigm, but also their attitudes towards these kinds of inventions. And, you know, again, TRIPS only requires a minimum. That's only the law on the books. Other countries, you may find that it's kind of difficult to protect your intellectual property, especially in biotech, because the TRIPS agreement also allows a number of exceptions. So the TRIPS agreement, Article 31, allows countries to award compulsory licenses on certain types of patents. often used for pharmaceuticals and other biotechnology. TRIPS agreement also allows countries to exclude from patentability things like diagnostics, therapeutic or surgical methods, even things like microorganisms or transgenic mice. So you may have difficulty protecting your biotech in those countries as well. And then again, a lot of it comes down to enforceability. Can you find a forum in which you can actually assert your exclusive rights and try to keep someone from copying your invention? And in a lot of countries, that's not always easy, especially if you're coming from outside the country. So those are things of which to be aware as well.
If you're thinking about a kind of two by two, you know, which on one axis has countries where the know-how and expertise and capital are available to compete with you, and on the other axis, degree of patent enforceability. So it seems like China stands out as a place where patent enforceability may be challenging and there is sophisticated ability to produce pharmaceuticals. First of all, do you think that's right? And are there other folks in that category? And how should a listener think about the patent universe in that way?
So first of all, we probably ought to dispel certain kind of lingering
yes,
stereotypes. I think we worry about a lot about China, global competitiveness. And yeah, there are geopolitical implications of China's technological advances. One of the reasons China's making technological advances, though, is because it's been investing in its innovation system, including its IP system.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, most patents in the world are filed in China. The most IP court cases are in China. It has an increasingly sophisticated IP system. So, you know, I think people who still may be behind on this may think of China as a pirate nation.
Yeah.
That really isn't the case so much. Now, the problem, though, is just because you have a legal system that is sophisticated and the semblance of the rule of law, the concern often is there really the full rule of law there? And so what we see sometimes in China, the complaints that companies have in China are that it seems like when they're doing something that the government may consider strategic, that you're less likely to get your patent granted. And an academic did a study, and they found exactly that. There's a statistically significant difference. You're slightly less likely to get granted a patent in a technology the Chinese government has identified as strategic when you're filing for a patent in China. But notice what I said there. It's not like it's not blatant, right? It took some statistics
less
to detect it.
Yep.
Or your court case seems to just not go as well as you expect. It's slower. And it turns out the other guy, you know, the Chinese company has a Chinese patent that they countersue on that might not seem like such a great patent, but boy, that part of the case, your adversary's case goes really well. And so that's the sort of thing, the thumb on the scales people worry about. Thumb on the scales can be pretty heavy-handed, and it happens in other ways. Stories about, you know, your shipment sits on the docks spoiling, or
yep,
if it's hardware, rusting, you know, in customs. There's all sorts of things that can happen. So that is a problem. But with that said, I think most... I talked to somebody at a big pharma company years ago, and they said to me, yeah, I've been able to persuade my bosses that going into China is kind of risky and we should abstain. You know, it's just because once you get entangled, you're kind of at the mercy of the government. And then a few years later, I heard him talking about their company's China strategy. So what happened? He said, well, new C-suite, and they've got to grow the company, and China's a place to grow the company. And I think that's inevitably going to happen. So companies find a variety of strategies for how to deal with China. Meanwhile, I'll just more quickly end here. Like a lot of the sophisticated emerging economies have looked at what China has done, and they understand that they want to move up the value chain and they want their own innovative industries that are high paying and lucrative and drive their economies. And so they've started to follow suit. India has made improvements to its patent system, its patent operations. It's moved up the innovation index that the World Intellectual Property Organization puts out. When I talk to government officials in places like Indonesia and Malaysia, they get it. And it's not everywhere in the world, but there are a lot of emerging economies that quote unquote get it. And they want an effective IP system because they see themselves as future innovators as well. And that's what it takes to get IP support in these countries.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And Josh, do you want to add something there?
Yeah, I'll add two quick things on China. So one of the complexities on the litigation side, in the U.S., every case is published. We can look at the opinion and we know what happened. You can disagree with it or not, but at least you know what happened and you can study it. In China, many of the cases aren't ever published. So we know what we know and we don't know what we don't know. It does seem like the system is getting better there, but it's very hard to say exactly how it works because many of the cases you can't get even a Chinese copy of, let alone an English copy, which creates questions. The other trick on China, and this is not a reason not to do business there, but for a lot of cases, the government kind of steps in. If you want to get rights there and produce there, you have to make certain deals and give up certain things, which is, it's definitely a factor to consider and worth a serious discussion before you do anything there. Again, not to say don't do it, but because it's a very big market, so it is quite valuable, but they do influence companies that are coming in, and it is a factor.
So go in with your eyes open. Don't necessarily run away from it. I liked your point, Mark. New C-Suite says, if you want to grow, hard to stay away from China. Understand whether your technology is in a strategic industry, something that the government is prioritizing. And I guess get advice, right? Talk to people that know this space well. That's really helpful. Emily, did you have something there? Yeah.
Yeah. So again, we're a common law system. And so exactly as Joshua said, they're a civil law system. You know, they have very different litigation practices than we do. But there was another study that showed that companies, U.S. companies that sue to enforce their patent rights in China actually do fairly well, as long as they don't fall within that category of strategic technologies, and that they do particularly well in terms of damages. So a Chinese colleague of mine once told me that if you're a foreign company, you're much more likely to get a large damage award than if you're a Chinese company. And that the reason this is true is that a lot of the Chinese companies aren't being as forthright about their finances as a lot of the foreign companies. The foreign companies can come in and produce all kinds of documentation about what their damages are from an infringement, whereas the Chinese companies are a little more reluctant to do that.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, I would not have guessed that. The logic makes a lot of sense, but I would not have guessed that foreigners would do better on damages. Okay. Yeah, Joshua Moore.
One quick thing to add on that. It's certainly true that foreigners do a bit better in China in damages than Chinese companies, but the damages there are still quite different from damages here. So there's a massive factor of scale on that. So don't think you're getting billion-dollar judgments in China. That's not a thing at the moment.
That's not going to happen. Okay. At least not in the current world that we live in. Okay, great. I'm going to switch gears now to regulatory. And I think you guys said you were going to completely clear up all of the ambiguities around the regulatory environment. So I'm really excited for this part of the conversation. Emily, I think you were going to lead off with a couple of opening thoughts here. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've been party to a lot of conversations about what's going to happen, both with the regulatory context, the FDA, the other government agencies, but also with intellectual property under the new administration. And everyone says, who knows? Right? I think the biggest concern is a lot of these mass layoffs. How is that going to affect how quickly and how easily you're able to get whatever you need from the government agencies? So like with the FDA, is that going to slow down approval of new pharmaceuticals and new biologics? With the PTO, is that going to slow down your ability to obtain a patent? And if you do obtain a patent, is that going to slow down your ability to get inter partes review and reexamination of your patent? And so there's a lot of these kinds of concerns. But at the same time, I also hear a lot of people say, hey, look, new administration, new opportunities, right? The administration hasn't, as far as I know, come out with any kind of statement about its policies regarding intellectual property, regarding pharmaceutical pricing and things like that. So a lot of people see this as an opportunity to kind of step in and say, well, once you develop a policy, this is what your policy should look like. The other thing that I worry about is the cut in funding, federal government funding, to a lot of the research. This won't affect companies necessarily right away because a lot of private companies aren't dependent on federal government funding in order to do their research. But as Mark mentioned, you know, research in biotechnology is often multiple stages across many, many years. And so a lot of what we see now as new medications, groundbreaking new medications, stem from new discoveries, new biologic pathways, new biologic mechanisms, new biologic agents that were discovered 10, 20 years prior. And so if we now are cutting funding for that kind of basic research, 10, 15, 20 years from now, we may see a drying up of the pipeline of new biotech inventions because we didn't have that basic research foundation from which we could build these new treatments or new devices or other just new biotech. So that's, I think, for me, a particular concern.
Yeah. So I think one of the challenges when you have a new administration is finding the way to frame your argument. I remember talking to people in the copyright industries about the Biden administration, and they said, well, when we want to do something on IP, we got to work with the unions. Like, we can't just go in there as the content owners. We get like the guys who build the sets and they like send their, we get the union on side, and then the Biden administration will listen to us. And so I think like people are looking for those keys here. And some of those, obviously, every administration wants to hear about how you're going to help them improve the economy or what policies will help them improve. The arguments about global competitiveness, particularly with respect to China, sound very strongly with both this Congress and administration potentially. And I guess maybe bigger picture arguments about, you know, what benefits all of people, humankind. You know, the future. What do we owe ourselves and future generations? But one challenge there, particularly in the biopharma market, is people are concerned with prices. And while there's always a groundswell for talking about what we owe future generations with regard to things like climate change, I think there seem to be people who, particularly politicians, who'd be willing to wreck the future biopharma industry in order to get cheap drugs for seniors today. And that is a continuing challenge in the American political environment. We've seen headwinds there for decades, but they've been really strong the last 10 years. And unfortunately, it's a bipartisan problem sometimes.
Yeah, right. There's getting mad at big pharma seems to be something that causes a lot of heads to nod on both sides of the aisle. You know, I think pharma has some work to do to tell a story that advocates for the continued improvement of medicines and the impact that'll have on humanity. Josh, I know you wanted to say something here.
Yeah, so this administration, particularly with DOGE, is taking very much a Silicon Valley style, go past, break things, and then fix, which, you know, you can argue whether that ever works for government or not, but it only can work if people actually respond quickly. If something has happened which is impacting your business, you have to let them know. If a lot of companies reach out and say, hey, this is destroying our ability to function here, they'll probably take that into account. If you feel that way and are backing off on stuff but not telling them, they may not know, and it may take longer to fix things. So it really is on sort of all of us to go out there and be loud, be noisy, let your representatives know they will pass it up the chain. And if there's enough response, things might change, which is, I think, is always important.
I think that's a great point. Have you guys been surprised at the lack of loudness from the biopharma industry in response to this? Or do you think that it has seemed somewhat measured, the response on some of these issues? Do you think that's smart? Or do you think they should be like grabbing their megaphones?
I don't know that I would necessarily say that they've been relatively quiet, because we know that some of the CEOs of the big pharmaceutical companies did meet with the Trump administration. There was some criticism of them for being a little more positive in their tone and they're talking with the Trump administration than some might think was warranted. Again, I think some part of this is just the unpredictability, right? And so exactly as Joshua said, you know, if you let the administration know, hey, look, what you're doing is hurting us, it's going to hurt us in terms of our global dominance and, you know, the America First policy, then they might be more likely to back off. And so I think the pharmaceutical industry is trying to get ahead of that, trying to let the administration and Congress know what they think is important. At the same time, you know, also treading very carefully. And I think everyone's treading very carefully in terms of what they say and in terms of what they ask for.
The physician's rule, right? Do no harm. I agree. There's some, at least some caution, I think, about that. And who knows, maybe that will turn out to be wise. Josh, did you want to add something there?
Yeah. So I think the bigger companies probably have more concerns with stepping out and getting attention drawn to them.
Yes.
That's fair. I think if you're a small company and this is going to, you know, destroy your ability to get funding and wipe you out, then there's no harm in talking because you're already toast.
Raise your voice. Yeah, right.
And I think those voices probably, the administration is less likely to get into the drug pricing arguments with them. So I think that they're the ones whose voices probably matter a bit more, at least at the moment. And, you know, a lot of small companies calling potentially sway things differently than a few big companies saying the same thing.
Mark, yeah.
But I have to acknowledge, though, that I know for smaller companies, they're focused on their business. I've been at many policy forums with government and business, and they'll say, why aren't there more startups here? And I always laugh on the inside. I say, because they're building companies.
They're working.
Yeah. They don't have time for this. But I think what it does, what you do have time for is an email or a call,
yeah,
and just being generally aware, you know, to the extent you belong to a group or that you just have your local representative, just let them know you exist and mm-hmm. that this is important to you. I think that's something everyone can do.
It's great advice. It's a light lift, right, to call a constituent office or send an email or something like that. And if it's important to you, make your voice heard. I also really like that point about reframing the way you approach new administration, new model. So if labor was a key to unlock in the Biden administration, it's going to be a different set of keys in the Trump administration. So thinking that through makes a lot of sense as well. This new episode of the Few and Far Between podcast is brought to you by BioRossi. For over 20 years, BioRossi has been the go-to CRO for small and mid-sized biopharma companies, from oncology, dermatology, and neurology to standalone data services and clinical trial rescue. BioRossi drives study results through reliable, flexible, and accessible solutions provided by our one team of industry experts. Connect today at biorossi.com/contact-us. Now, back to the podcast. Going to move us to the future. So I know there are a couple of bills making their way through Congress that are interesting. Does anybody want to talk about what we might see in terms of the changing environment? Who wants to pick up their crystal ball and project forward a little bit on some of the things that could be happening?
There are three patent-focused bills that are at different stages in both the House and the Senate, and that have, I think, different odds in both the House and the Senate, which I can talk a little bit about, and that have also, for your audience, I think one of them is probably the most important. So the three bills are Prevail, which is on IPRs, which important for some big companies, probably not such a big deal for smaller biotech companies, but certainly, you know, feel free to reach out to us or talk to your attorneys if you have questions on it. You have PERA, which is the Patent Eligibility Restoration Act, which I think is a big deal, at least for a subset of your audience. So for patents, which we talked about, there are basically two things that can stop you from getting patents. So there's patent eligibility and patentability. Patentability is anticipation, obviousness, enablement, and written description. They're fairly well defined. Courts can figure it out. Companies can kind of know pretty well in advance what's is going to stop you or not. And the guidelines are sort of clear. They have their own issues, but they're not major concerns in terms of questions. Patent eligibility is something which is very much up in the air at the moment. In the statute, it's quite limited as to what was actually not eligible for patent. So patent eligibility says this type of invention is categorically exempt. It's not something you can get a patent on, regardless of how innovative it is, regardless of how interesting it is. None of that matters. The Supreme Court in the last 15 years or so has added a number of exceptions, which have made things complicated for both software and also for life sciences, particularly for diagnostics. Pure diagnostic methods are just not eligible at all right now. If you do something with it, it's possible, but it really depends on how much you do. And it's something that's complicated for courts. It seems to vary court to court. Even if you appeal, what the Fed Circuit will do depends a little bit on what the panel is. So the answer is there are some things which are, you know, obviously eligible, right? And you can go to an attorney and they'll say, yes, you can definitely get a, you know, this is definitely the kind of thing. There's some things they'll say, this is absolutely not. And there's a lot of stuff which is sort of in the middle, and they'll say, you might get it through the office. And then in 10 years when you sue, it might be eligible or it might not. And I can't tell you, which is really hard to invest in and to spend lots of money bringing something to market if you're like, well, I don't know if I can actually protect this. And in diagnostics, it's generally on the no side, which has created lots of complexity in the last few years as to where new diagnostics are being built, where they're being innovated. And there's ways to get around that if you can't get a patent. You can do it through trade secrets. You can have people mail you samples and test it yourself and not explain what you're doing. But that's not really good. So PERA would fix that. And it's getting some progress in the Senate. It may move in the House. There's slight variances between the two. It's always hard to guess as, you know, what the odds of a particular legislation passing. Particularly that one's, it's somewhat early. You know, I can say what I've heard from some Senate staffers is that there's good chance of continued movement on that, whether it passes next year or two, no, but it's still up for serious consideration. The House, however, is much more interested in the America versus the rest of the world and how bills impact there. And I think it has not really been explained to them why this bill would help America and not help China in the same way or help other countries. You know, unless that can be, you know, spelt out for them, they may not move on it. So I think there's a chance of it, you know, getting through the next level in the Senate and getting stuck in the House without changes in the House or changes in how people are pushing the bill.
Got it. Super helpful. I mean, so that does sound like plugging a hole or fixing a problem in our patent system, right? Or am I reading that right? Do you guys think of this as a positive, that change for diagnostics? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Absolutely. It'll be good. And not just diagnostics, but also biologics.
Yeah. Okay.
A lot of which are derived from, you know, existing biologic systems, organisms. And so I think PERA would make it easier to get patents on those kinds of things, which, again, I think would be helpful and provide a lot of positive incentives. And of course, those who are worried about the prices of pharmaceuticals or medical devices and treatments generally are going to push back against that. But I think having some certainty, right, just some certainty, regardless of which direction you're going, exactly as Joshua said, would be helpful as well.
That's great. That makes a lot of sense. All right, this last section, advice for biotech CEOs. So you're sitting down with somebody who's either formed a new company or just taken the helm at a smaller company. So they're not going to have access to all of the expertise that they would in a larger organization. What are some things that they should focus on? Who wants to start us out?
I can start. It really all starts with great science. And I don't need to tell your listeners about that, but it's kind of important to get in these IP discussions. Like, you know, if a company's focused on its patents first, then it has a problem.
Yeah.
But once you get beyond that great science, it's the IP that brings money and security. You care about the IP because it's central to your story. It shows, you know, what you've done that's innovative, that can be protected, that essentially makes you a good investment. I talked to Derek Rossi, who is the academic founder of Moderna. I talked to him before the pandemic for a project I was doing. He's probably impossible to reach these days. He's so famous.
Mark, I think you just told us that you knew Moderna before they were cool.
That's exactly it. Yeah, just a couple months. So I wasn't surprised when they emerged as they did. But Rossi said to me that he said, you could be working on the coolest thing in the world, and without IP, you're not going to get investment.
Yeah.
You know, and he's so fun to talk to. He started 5 or 6 biotech companies. He loves the science. He tells these great gee whiz stories. You just get so excited. But when he comes down to the bottom line, he says, science first, but then IP. And that's, you know, something you got to think about.
Yeah. As rules of thumb go, that sounds like a pretty good one for folks to keep in mind. Other advice. Yeah, Emily.
Yeah, I'd follow up on that. So not only, you know, science first, then IP, but as we kind of started the podcast with, know your different types of IP, right? Know what's required to get a patent. Know what's required to assert trade secrecy. Know the things to avoid, too. So Joshua mentioned that there are some things that you could do unknowingly to basically forfeit, waive your right to get a patent. So especially if you're an academic or someone else similar to that who, you know, isn't necessarily in the business world, doesn't have that kind of business sophistication, but you think you have a product that you could spin off into something really great, you need to be aware of if you publish and describe what you're doing in a scientific article, you're starting the clock. Right? And you need to be able to file that provisional or non-provisional patent application as soon as possible. Mark talked a lot about how IP allows a lot of collaboration. Well, if you're collaborating, make sure you know the rules about co-inventorship, right? And co-ownership of patents, because a lot of times you could be bringing in some really great people who have some really great knowledge, but the companies for whom those people work might say, well, now we have a piece of the pie.
Yeah, we've got a claim here.
Yeah, and now we don't owe you. With a patent especially, you have, as a co-owner, you have unilateral rights to make any kind of license or other arrangement to allow use of the invention without having a duty of accounting to the other co-owners. And so it's good to have some sort of agreement up front if you're going to go into these collaborations.
Very, very helpful. And Mark, I think you had a follow-up point there.
Oh, just a small point. I know this can sound like a lot, and we're not saying you have to become a patent lawyer. But it's just the sort of thing when you go from being an expert in your subject matter domain to trying to start a business, you have to learn things. You have to learn how to read a balance sheet, and you have to learn about, you know, how to manage and lead employees, and a little bit at least about employment law. And it's the same with IP. If you want to succeed in this business, it's just something you got to have some basic knowledge about.
I like that. Yeah, that's it's just on the list of things that a harried CEO needs to get minimal competence on and good advice, probably. Josh, did you have a comment there as well?
Yeah, trying not to get into the weeds too much, but I think something, particularly in this day and age, that's important that we didn't get a chance to discuss yet, AI tools and what happens if you use them. There's two things to be really careful with there. And one, I'll say that the PTO and Copyright Office have put out guidelines. The PTO has also just pulled back some guidelines because of changed administration. So the answer is to what the rules are is who knows. And, you know, candidly, even if the PTO guidance had stayed, until it's tested by courts, it may still change, which means that you just have to be paying attention and talk to a lawyer about this. So if you use AI as part of the inventive process, then you have to at least be able to explain to the PTO and certainly have records for later if it goes in court, what you did versus what the AI did. That's going to be a question that's important. And if you don't have records to answer that, it's going to cause trouble. So I think right now, be careful how you're using it. The second one to be really careful with is if you're using a lot of the public AI tools, they train on your data. So anything you type into it may not be yours anymore. So your trade secret may be lost. And even a patent application, if it's published elsewhere, it may be priored against you. So if you're going to use these tools, make sure you know that they're not taking your data at all. You do something you have control of on site. And at least be very careful with anything you put in something public, because it's public, it's not necessarily yours anymore.
Is that true if someone, let's say, a junior member of your team who's using AI, maybe you're not even aware of it? Are you incurring risk there? Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Just as much as if they go in a bar and blab about it after work,
Yeah.
Just to say.
So having some kind of AI education policy is probably a pretty good idea. AI use policy is probably a pretty good idea as well. I think great point, Joshua. And I think folks don't necessarily think of it as the same as blabbing in a bar. So that's a good watch out. I want to move to your areas of research and interest. Folks who are listening to this, if they're interested in getting in touch with you guys, how can they learn more? So if there's social media stuff that you're doing or contacts you want to share, please do. So Emily, let's start with you.
So yeah, if people want to get in touch with me, I'm on the University of Akron Law School's website. I'm also a member of our new institute, the Intellectual Property Policy Institute, which all three of us are members. And so things that I do, obviously, I focus a lot on biopharmaceuticals and patents and the regulatory context for all of those kinds of things. And so if you have questions or comments, I'd love to hear them. And can I just throw in, I know this is kind of off topic, but can I just throw in too, we were talking earlier about speaking up, right, about things that are important to you. And Mark mentioned the importance of science, right? And I mentioned the importance of funding for basic science. And perhaps this is a self-serving comment, but also speak up for the universities. Universities, I think, are a little hesitant to speak up for themselves sometimes, but the universities are the ones who are training your future scientists. And they're also the ones who are doing the kind of basic research that can lead to new biotechnology. And so we need to make sure that the universities are being supported because they're a root of a lot of what's going on in the biotech space and will be very, very important for continued dominance in the biotech market.
Here, here. That's an incredibly important argument to make. And I agree. I have not seen universities give a full-throated defense of that yet. I hope we'll see more of that as we go forward. Joshua, do you want to share interests and contact for you?
Yeah, so contact information is very much the same as Emily. You can find me on the University of Akron website, and our institute's website should be up soon. I'm also pretty active on LinkedIn, and I'm certainly happy to talk to anyone by email. My main focus is patents, a mix of both tech and life sciences. Prior to law school, I was doing computational biology and bioinformatics, so I kind of play in a lot of areas, but very heavily on the biotech side, and always happy to chat with people.
Fantastic. And Mark?
Sure. So some of the things I look at are international competitiveness and innovation and trade strategies, both at the national and international level. But specifically this year, probably of more interest to listeners, is I've been doing a lot of empirical research on trends in venture capital investment and just seeing how changes in the patent system and the regulatory environment are affecting companies that particularly rely on IP. I guess the punchline is it's a complicated story if you ask a researcher, it always is. But, investors, they want to put their money somewhere. And lately, I'd say the last 20 years, they're relatively shifting away from the more IP-intensive industries into things like social media and brand lifestyle brands and hotels and the like. So you can find me on LinkedIn, and please, yeah, follow me, follow our new IP Policy Institute, and we'll be out there fighting for sound IP and innovation policy in the United States and throughout the world. And thanks for giving us a chance to talk, Chris.
Thanks all three of you for coming on. It's a really interesting conversation. Really a pleasure to have you on Few and Far Between.
Many thanks to you.
Thank you.
All right. Welcome, producer Adam. What did you think of that?
It was just, there's so much I don't know about IP. And in the biotech space, there's so many rules and regulations. If you don't approach it correctly, there could be issues. When do you think it needs to be involved in a company's strategy?
Yeah. I mean, I think they were really clear on this, that you want to be thinking about IP from the very beginning. You want to think, do I have something that's patentable or protectable? But then, of course, you got to think about how much money you want to spend to go through the process. And once you start exploring collaboration, I think they were really clear on the fact that you're exposed if you haven't started patent protection process.
Yeah, again, just a lot of information there. And I really like the concept of how you need to balance great science with IP security. Otherwise, it's impossible to tell your story.
Yeah, I agree. I like that a lot, too. I think a lot of us think of patents as defensive instruments that are you use to protect yourself. But I really like this point that they enable collaboration because, you can have these conversations out in public. I loved the example of the COVID pandemic and how people were able to share IP to move quickly to get vaccines developed and distributed. That made a lot of sense to me. I think the balance thing is getting your staff to understand that by putting proprietary information integration into a large language model or having discussions in the marketplace for things that are not patented, that could be great for discovery, but really dangerous in terms of IP protection.
And to go along with that, it seems like, you know, in terms of IP protection, the US model has amazing security, but what about global IP? It's a very challenging area.
It is. I think the takeaway for me was to really focus on the US first. I think that's what everybody was suggesting. And then think about what end markets you want to be in. So if you're preclinical, please don't take this as legal advice. Speak to an expert. But I wouldn't be too concerned about the international piece then. But if you're starting to head towards the clinic and you haven't developed an IP strategy, worked with someone who's an IP strategy expert, I think you're making a mistake.
So one of the things, like you were saying, collaboration is an amazing opportunity that is made possible by IP. And it was so important during COVID. Now that everything is kind of subsided with the pandemic, do you think it's still a viable concept?
I really do. And I think we often talk in the life sciences about the ways in which the pandemic accelerated acceptance of new technologies and new ways of working and, you know, remote and clinical trials, things like remote monitoring and all that stuff. I hadn't thought about it in this context. And I don't think they were suggesting this was novel, but the speed with which they moved and the fact that it involved one of the largest players in pharma and a relatively small but innovative biotech company partnering effectively with each other, I think it's a great example. And I suspect that we'll see more of that.
Okay. And the last thing I wanted to talk about, and not to put you on the spot, but you mentioned a lack of loudness in biopharma over the latest regulatory funding cuts. Do you think they're treading slowly, or do you think they're more walking on eggshells at this point?
I think a little more walking on eggshells. I think everyone is trying to figure out what the most effective way to lobby the administration and make the case for the importance of funding, clarity around regulation, and actually regulators is. I think that's all incredibly important, and I hope the industry will raise its voice even more. Some of that's going to be about partnering with people who are effective in communicating with the administration. We're starting to see people using language that resonates more with Secretary Kennedy and others. And I think we'll see more of that as we go forward. I think the industry is starting to get its arms around this. Thank you for listening to the latest episode of Few and Far Between, conversations from the front lines of drug development. Our podcast is now available on Apple Podcasts and other streaming services. Please take a moment and leave us a user review and rating today. It really helps people discover the podcast, and we read all the comments. Those comments help us make Few and Far Between better and better. Also, be sure to subscribe to Few and Far Between so you don't miss a single episode. Got an idea for a future episode? Email us at fewandfarbetween@biorossi.com or contact us on our website at biorossi.com. I'm your host, Chris O'Brien. See you next time.